In these currency wars, there is one force that stands neutral as a safe haven, as an exit strategy, as an opportunity for people to say, you know what? You go ahead. I'm going to opt out. And that's Bitcoin.
Jake, how you doing this morning?
Oh, great, man.
Take three of episode two.
Yeah, we've had two false starts. That's okay, though.
Hey, third time's the charm.
Well, at least it's not live. Well, I mean, if it was live, it would still be comical because, once again, the ferret interrupts the broadcast.
I suppose you can play it off in a live broadcast a little bit better, you know, whereas this, you just feel so awkward having to actually sit down and do it again. But
well, the added element of the ferret does make for good radio.
Oh, God. You know, we were talking the other night about dosing our pets with C60 to, you know, see if it actually increases their lifespan.
Jokingly, anybody from the FDA?
I don't actually know if I want to do that with this ferret. He's so goddamn annoying sometimes, but that's neither here nor there. Jake, we're here this morning to talk about our experience with Light Wallet clients. Some have been fantastic. I know we're both users of Electrum and recommend it wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. Some are not so fantastic. We have an article up on the site right now entitled Cryptocurrency Security 101 and the Risk of Exchanges. And it pretty much just goes through three methods of storing your coins off exchange. One being a hardware wallet, a paper wallet is discussed. And then in the last portion, we talk about wallet applications. But of course, that's a subject with a lot of breadth. And I mention in there that you have to be careful where you store your coins on wallet clients, especially Light Wallet clients, because you don't know who is controlling your private keys on the other end. You don't know who is necessarily hosting that copy of the blockchain. So you don't know when you're going to have access to your coins or not. And then furthermore, if you're storing those coins on a compromised operating system, like a Windows machine, it really doesn't matter how good your wallet security is if the underlying operating system is compromised. Jake, we both had a set of terrible experiences with a wallet called Jax. And before we launch into, you know, this skewer fest on this piece of crap wallet, I do want to say, Charlie Schrem, if you're listening, I highly doubt you're listening. Charlie Schrem, I think, is the CEO of Jax. I love you, buddy. I like what you've done over the years. I love what you've done for Bitcoin. I think you were really naive in telling federal agents about your participation in Silk Road, thinking you could get off because you're an entrepreneur now. But thanks for doing the years. We appreciate that, you know, Bitcoin political prisoner and all. That being said, man, your latest venture, this wallet, is it might be one of the worst pieces of software I've ever used, Jake.
No, I would agree with that. And you even warned me about it, and I did not heed the warning. So it was, my experience was what, a couple months after yours?
Yeah, maybe 2-3 months after, and it was pretty much the exact same experience.
And I just watched my hash rate on my mining rig go from 800 sols to 384, and that's kind of concerning. But, well, I guess we can troubleshoot that here in a minute. But anyway... you had an experience. Why don't you talk about yours first, and then I'll piggyback on my stupidity and not heeding your warning about what we can actually do.
Yeah, sorry, you were breaking up a little bit there, Jake, but what were you saying?
Oh, I was just saying that why don't you start, and then we can talk about how I didn't heed your warning about the Jax client and almost found myself out of some mining profits.
Oh, goodness. Well, the downtime can't be that long. Man, you really got to get that stuff automated. It's not that hard.
No, it's fine. It's fine now.
I'll walk you through it.
It went down to 384, and now we're back up to 800. I don't know what happened right there.
Okay, yeah. Jake is hashing, I think, Zcash right now, if you guys aren't aware. Those hash rates are definitely way too high for Ethereum. man, 800 hashes a second on Ethereum, that'd be something else.
All right, but anyway, why don't you go into your debacle, and then I will actually plug something that I dissed on the last podcast, so I'm glad it never aired, but I'm actually going to sing its praises now, because it's pretty decent, even though it's written in Java. So go ahead.
Yeah, so there is a Light Wallet service by Charlie Schrem called Jax, and a Light Wallet, for those who don't know, is essentially just a wallet client that where the blockchain is hosted by another party. Typically, this is sometimes this third party is a network of other hosts. In the case of something like Electrum, where it's an open source client, so people are voluntarily hosting these nodes, and the downtime is virtually nil because you have so many different backups of the same blockchain. Whereas in the case of Jax, this is a company that is hosting these copies of the blockchain on your behalf. There's a high profile issue with this wallet earlier this year when $400,000, roughly $400,000 worth of Ethereum, Zcash, and I believe one other altcoin were stolen from this wallet because the private keys were not encrypted on the user side, and they're just sitting there. So anyone who has access to that machine and knows what they're doing can literally just go in and just copy paste your private keys, and they've got your coins. I don't know if this has been fixed since then or if there were any plans to fix that, but that's how that theft occurred. Just terrible security. But Jake, what we experienced is something a little bit different with Jax, and that is uptime, which was horrendous. So again, when someone else is hosting the blockchain on your behalf, they have to keep it running or else your wallet services don't work. And Jax's downtime, if you're a sysadmin and you've heard about uptime and downtime, you know, that's your lifeblood. And Jax is doing just a terrible job of it. I mean, I think I've gone to use the thing. Well, it's been months since I've actually used it. But when I went to use the thing, it was down more often than it was up. It didn't refresh properly. What ended up happening is I had to pull my private keys. I tried resetting the cache. That didn't work. I had to pull my private keys from that wallet service and enter them into another service. And that, Jake, is what their customer support told me to do, which is horrendous. If you are... If you're on customer support and you're telling people use the competition, you do not believe in your product. That's pretty pitiful.
And it's ironic that that's the exact same thing that they told me when I submitted my support ticket.
Three, four months later. So they haven't gotten any better.
Yeah, I was lazy. I really didn't think that was going to happen to me. But what I did do is I told you it would. Well, I heeded your warning a little bit. And what I did was I took all the mining that I had of Zcash at that point and moved it into a different wallet, which was into an exchange wallet, which I thought was going to be safer for the time being because it wasn't a lot of profit. So I just moved it over there, and I was like, well, I got to find something else. And in that time, I just never really found anything that was going to be good. So...
Well, let's get into that, too, yeah. Because Zcash is the coin that we're both mining at the time, and it's still a very young coin. I think it launched in, like, November of 2016, and they only have a Linux client for it up still, I'm pretty sure.
Not anymore. All right, so I'll continue real quick, and then...
My point being is that these multi-coin light wallets at the time in March, April of this year, these were the only options for Zcash unless you wanted to run Linux. Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what I did was I started looking around, and I found another online wallet that I'm using as a temporary client. Because there was an experimental, not sanctioned by Zcash, that is a Windows-based version of the blockchain through Zcash. So I started downloading that, and it took about half a day, and I had half the block done. And then I did what Jax told me to do. First, I tried to reboot my clear my cache, and then reboot my wallet, and nothing happened. And so I waited about half a day, as you and I both discussed, or you both discussed earlier, that. The client wasn't up and available very often, so I gave it some time. I was like, well, maybe it'll be back up later on this afternoon. So I re-imported my keys and my passphrase, and eventually my wallet came up, grabbed my private keys off of that, and continued to download them onto a different client. In the meantime, shifting my mining endeavor to a different wallet hosted online called Kryptonator, which has actually been pretty good so far. And after I was able to get all the block downloaded, the wallet was fantastic. So I imported my private keys. Everything came up instantaneously. I was really pleased with that. I moved those coins out of that wallet into something else so I could exchange it for a different currency. And it's been fantastic so far. So after it will take you for Windows users like myself. It will take you about depending on your internet connection at the time, it'll probably take you about a day, maybe 18 hours to download the entire blockchain. But well worth it if you're having some of these issues that we've run into, or if you think that it would be better to actually store them on a client that would be directly connected to the network.
Yeah, well, and that's about going to be about the same download time whether you're on Linux, Mac, or Windows. It's sure. about a day and a half to download the Zcash blockchain. I want to say it's around 5 or 6 gigabytes now. So mm-hmm. it's not tremendously a tremendous amount of space that it's going to be taking up. Unlike, you know, Ethereum, that blockchain's already 30 or 40 gigs.
It took me 2.5 days to download the entire Ethereum wallet, and then I still had to update for another half a day. So yeah, that's a really hefty file.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of Ethereum, to be honest with you, but the light wallet clients and services for Ethereum are quite good. Mm-hmm. I have some negative things to say about my Ether wallet. But generally, it's a decent and decentralized product where you don't really have to worry about downtime that much. Mm-hmm. I'm fairly comfortable keeping not huge amounts, but you know, more sizable amounts of Ethereum in that web wallet. Whereas Zcash, you know, like we were saying, there really is no other good alternative. Although I have heard, Jake, that Trezor just implemented Zcash support. So hypothetically, you could store it in your hardware wallet now. The only issue with that is the way I've got my Trezor set up, Trezor is a hardware wallet. By the way, guys, you want to save $5 off of your Trezor or your Ledger Wallet Nano or KeepKey, any hardware device, check out our website at cryptohero.info. We've got deals lined up. You're getting $5 to $10 off depending on where you buy it if you go through one of our affiliate links. So that's just one of the perks of listening to this podcast, I guess. But they've recently got the Trezor set up now for a bunch of different coins. The issue is I have my Trezor personally set up to interface with Electrum. Mm-hmm. And because I use it primarily for Bitcoin. Whereas if I were to use it for these other coin services, I then also have to expose it to Trezor's closed source a web browser plugin, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I know how the Trezor works. It's a brilliant piece of engineering. The private keys are all generated and signed on a little single board computer, so they never technically hit the internet. Mm-hmm. It still makes me nervous.
There's a lot of things about mining and coin management that make me, or token management, that make me nervous as well, especially yeah. understanding some of the holes in Ethereum. Not to get too far off a topic, but I was in a LinkedIn debate with some of these. It's very interesting that you have industry professionals that are either network admins or sysadmins. And just because they understand network topography, they believe that they understand blockchain. They believe they understand everything that has to do with networking. And they really don't. They don't understand some of the vulnerabilities of some of these coins. They don't dive into it. And then when you call them on it, and then you post articles about it and point out the fact that, hey, you know what?
Which side are these sysadmins and netadmins, Jake? Are they true believers who think it's impervious, or are they on the flip side?
No,
it's junk.
They're the true believers in the fact that, you know, what I'm finding a lot too is especially in the professional networks, because I'm an independent IT professional. So my services include voice and data services, as well as network security and network engineering and appliance management, as well as any kind of security appliance management. So I don't administer those. I sell them and then connect the end user with the best there is as far as monitoring those appliances. So this is kind of my realm, and I like to be as well thought in that space as possible. And what you find is that there are two camps. There are the Bitcoin camps and there are the Ethereum camps. And so most of the time, the Ethereum camp people believe that it's impervious, that it's the next thing, because of all these promises that have been made on the Ethereum platform about smart contracts. And I point out the fact that some of these promises that have been made have not been realized, and then they get very offended, and then they start wondering, well, where are the holes in Ethereum? What are you talking about? And I simply point to the fact that Bitcoin's never had to do an entire rollback of their entire blockchain, which Ethereum has. Now, granted, it wasn't their quote-unquote fault, but still, you don't see anything like that happening with the Bitcoin network. So
Ethereum's greatest strength is its greatest weakness. The fact that it runs a Turing-complete language and you can build entire applications on top of it inherently means that there are far more vectors for attack, because the scripting language that you're writing it in, Solidity, is a far more powerful and full-featured language. Bitcoin, you know, the Bitcoin client, you can pass arguments to Bitcoin. You know, the Bitcoin D client, there's all sorts of little arguments you can pass to it. You can code in, you know, time-stamped multi-sig transactions. But that's the beauty and the limitation of Bitcoin, is that it's set up to be internet money. It's set up to be and function as digital gold, and it does that one job, and it does it very, very well. And as you stated, Jake, it's virtually impervious. So when people come along and say, you know, that Ethereum is somehow going to supplant it, and Andreas Antonopoulos talks about this, but it's just like, I'm not saying I whole hawk believe in Darwinian evolution as a dogma like some people do.
God, I hope not.
But it, you know, to use an evolution analogy, you know, if you take one fork of evolution, then you automatically limit yourself in other ways. You know, lions and tigers grew big fangs, and we grew hands. You know, so obviously they can, you know, rip animals to shreds much better than we can. But by their very nature, they can't develop tools or written language or preserve culture. So, you know, there are pros and cons to each developmental kind of path that you set yourself on. And Ethereum's path is nowhere in Ethereum's path does it say it's trying to be money.
No, absolutely it's not.
Ether is trying to be fuel for smart contracts that don't yet exist.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I tried to point out as well. And that was, you know, and it was met with a lot of rebuttal. Once again, people that understand what the technology can be, but it's not necessarily there. And if you point out the flaws, then somehow you're poo-pooing the idea of it. But it's not so much poo-pooing as it is being a realist. And you know, one of the coins or tokens that you like to talk about was Veritasium to me, you know. And that's a prime example of somebody that promises something. They promise that this product is going to do X, Y, and Z, and the product never delivers. And then when they say they're going to launch an alpha, they say, well, it's probably not a good idea for us to do this, because they don't have it. And, you know,
yeah,
I think that, you know, we've strained away from the wallet client a little bit, but this all kind of ties.
We are getting a little far field.
Well, it does tie in together, because, you know, understanding what some of these limitations are to some of these tokens might yield different storage places for different things.
Well, it does bring up a good point when you touch on Veritasium, because Veritasium does not yet even have a wallet client. Reggie Middleton, the CEO of Veritasium, I mean, he's been on CNBC. He's a big name. He's a really smart finance guy, to be honest with you, and a very gifted investor. I mean, the guy's a smart guy. There's no doubt about that. But he's been kicking around the Bitcoin space since 2014. He's had patents for something like Veritasium since, I want to say, 2011 or 2012. Still hasn't come out with an operable product, still hasn't released a wallet client for people to store these tokens in outside of Ethereum-based wallet clients. He was supposed to have an open beta out late this month. I want to say that he did actually give people a link to check out that alpha product, but only if you had a certain amount of tokens. So this is like kind of a for your eyes only type beta. And My issue with Veritasium, if you don't know what Veritasium is, it's this ICO. It's one of the earlier ICOs that just went to astronomical values based on the notion that it's going to essentially act as an intermediary for clearing of stocks and other digital assets. So Reggie Middleton is in talks right now with the Jamaican Stock Exchange and some other, you know, big stock exchanges to try and tokenize, you know, Wall Street, essentially, which is a really interesting concept, don't get me wrong. And I think it's one that, you know, but other companies are trying this, like Salt Lending and DTCC, Blythe Masters Company, what's that called, Digital Asset Holdings. So there's other big players in the space that are maybe going to beat him to the punch and because they have connections and they're nefarious scumbags. My issue with Reggie is that he offered this token. One, he controls 98% of the supply to this day. The Veritasium website, not the website, but their actual core protocol was breached, and a bunch of Veritasium were stolen. I'm not sure exactly how many were stolen, but that's interesting in and of itself. But he offers this token for sale to the public, and then after the public buys it and it goes up in value, he comes back to them and says, well, you're not my target audience. We're focused on institutional investors and large exchanges and nation states, so don't be surprised if we essentially give you nothing for a long time and focus on these big fish. And that's fine. That's a viable business model. I'm not saying it's wrong. My issue is, why would you sell it to average fucking Joes then, Reggie? Use their money to go fund your enterprise and then just essentially give them the middle finger as you're driving down, driving down Main Street in your limo to go cut deals with big fish. It's really disingenuous. If you wanted to raise money for an institutional, clientele, then poach institutional investors. You know, don't rope up, average people in your little schemes, Reggie.
Well, I think that we need to talk about ICOs in a future podcast, because what they were what they were supposed to be and what they have become now are two totally different entities, and that needs to be addressed wholeheartedly, because...
Or maybe not. Maybe they were all just scams to begin with.
That's possible. Very possible. So my take on the entire client wallet situation, kind of putting bookends on that piece of it, is that you are always better off going with the source wallet. And if you can get it, great. If you can't, wait for a workaround to come out and then dump your coins in there. So, like I said, I've been pleasantly surprised with the Windows version of the Zcash client. Am I going to store all of my coins in the world there? Probably not, just because it's not sanctioned and I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know who wrote the JavaScript for it.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Jake. The node itself is an official Zcash node. It's just the front end that's written in Java. That's honestly, that's the same open source Java client I use. It's very strange to be running Java on a Linux machine. Most of these front end wallets are written with Qt, which is a Python library.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's much lighter on the resources. So I don't know. It's kind of silly that it's written in this bulky language, but it does work well,
mm-hmm.
and it has undergone a full code audit. So there's nothing nefarious in there, from what people can see.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be somewhat secure in that notion. But you're totally right. You're totally right. If you have the ability with Bitcoin and Ethereum and some of these bigger coins, you have options.
Yeah.
To where you store your coins and store them safely. Hardware wallets are a great example. With these smaller coins, unless you're going to do true cold storage and generate a paper wallet, and quite frankly, most people don't know how to generate paper wallets. I had a guy, Jake, in a YouTube comment section I was looking at. He's like, why don't you just store it on your paper wallet? I made a MyEther wallet. I fund it all the time. I check it all the time, and there's just a little button. It says print paper wallet, and I've got it in my safe. It's like, you missed the point entirely of a paper wallet, guy. If you're using the wallet all the time, it's connected to the internet. You're constantly entering your private key. Like, it's completely compromised. Most people don't understand. You have to generate a paper wallet ideally on an offline, an uncompromised machine, so those keys never hit the internet, and you're just sending money into it. But again, this is why we're here, because there's a lot of crypto noobs. And there's also a lot of people who think they know what the hell they're talking about in this space.
And by the way,
I have no idea.
And by the way, everyone, I am a crypto noob. So Josh is I wish I had the. I should have hooked up the tablet. I should have hooked up the tablet. We could have given you a millennial coin for being a certified Bitcoin professional.
I am. I'm now officially a certified Bitcoin professional. I'm hoping to write an article about that and whether or not it's worth it. For my brief take, I'll write about this later in the week, but I think it really does have the potential to be like the CompTIA A+ exam of the crypto world.
So you can be a help desk guy. That's great.
And that's totally what it's what it's for. It's for help help desk Bitcoin people, as well as what I want to call consultants.
Yeah,
you know, blockchain and Bitcoin consultants who don't really need to know the technical nitty gritty, but at the same time need to be competent in talking about it to clients. And for that, I think it's really good. But again, that's topic for another day.
Yeah.
Jake, I wouldn't call you a crypto noob, though. A crypto noob, I think, is someone who bought in February of this year because their friend said it was going up, and now they're trying to catch up. Whereas, you know, you haven't really been big into it until this year, but you've dabbled in it for many years at this point.
Yep, and I fulfilled one of my yearly goals, and I recommend everybody do this, no matter if it's with a cryptocurrency or anything else. Is Take some time, sit down, spend about 15 minutes, and write down skills that you would like to learn this year. Because I think that's one of the things our society lacks is people with a bunch of different skills. You can be a professional in certain areas and then find yourself, like what happened to me, you can find yourself jobless. And so you have to find other avenues to make revenue. And I've shifted my idea from going and working at one sole company to creating multiple revenue streams for myself. So if I do lose that one job, that I'm not putting my family and myself in a predicament. And I would recommend that everyone do that. Especially mining is a good way to do it. As long as the market is up, you can make passive income. I know Josh is. I don't know. Have you written the article about the Raspberry Pi to create passive income yet?
No, we're definitely going to get that one out, because even if mining can be expensive,
yes,
and mining contracts are sometimes not a good idea. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people think, oh well, I don't have to do the hardware, I don't have to pay for this. But Jake, for example, Genesis Mining is a really big mining company. To get the same hash rate that your rig is currently getting with Genesis, it costs just shy of $4,000. I ran the numbers the other day for that mining contract.
Wow, for how long?
That's a 2-year contract. But again, the network difficulty is constantly increasing, and the hardware is constantly getting better.
You're not going to make your money back.
Yeah, and you're stuck at a fixed rate. Yeah. Well, hey, you know, if you were to have signed it optimistically in March of this year, you could have run those numbers and been like, hey, I'm profitable in 6 months.
Yeah.
Now, though, it's a different scenario. You know, that's why it's always good to own your own hardware. Even though you're paying for the electricity, even though you have some out-of-pocket expenses, you can choose at that point, hey, do I need to scale this rig up to make it more profitable? Or, hey, this isn't working for me anymore, but I still have $1,000, $2,000 in computer gear that's perfectly good that I can now flip and get some of that money back.
And exactly. I mean, and one of the other
renting
things...
Renting versus owning, man.
Right. And the other thing is being able to shift coins and shift your focus. And the main reason that I use it and the main reason that I do mine is not... I mean, it's to make passive income, yes. And how much passive income am I making? Since Zcash went up to $400 and then crashed down to around $170, I'm not making nearly the profit that I was when I first started mining, because everybody jumped on board when it went from like $116 all the way up to $400. So my hash rates went down from every seven or eight hours. I was 5 hours at the very beginning.
To
pay out all the way down to now I'm 15 hours on average. So there's a giant leap, but the reason that I do it is, yes, I'm probably making a little bit of I'm beating my power bill maybe by 15%, but it's because I believe in the technology and I want to be part of the network and I want to be part of the revolution of shifting us away from fiat currency to something that technically could be a currency of the future, not necessarily Zcash, but just the concept of having a rig to be able to compete and being able to help secure the network, to me was the biggest draw and the reason that I do it to this day.
And I did the same thing, Jake, with, from the first coin I ever really seriously mined was a Vertcoin, and that was that's a failed coin. Mm-hmm. But the Vertcoin's whole shtick was that it was an ASIC-resistant algorithm, so it was catered towards GPU miners, but it didn't really offer any new features or services outside of that, at least at launch. Mm-hmm. Darkcoin, that it became Dash, is the next one that I really threw my weight behind, And I was selling a lot of it for Bitcoin at the time, but I mined it because not just because it was profitable, because it was the most technically interesting coin that was happening at the time, and I felt comfortable supporting that blockchain. Mm-hmm. And Zcash is something very similar. You know, whether or not I hold or sell the Zcash at any given time, I think is immaterial. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a really interesting privacy protocol, and I'm willing to support the network to see how it evolves.
Yeah. And I think
that's how you feel too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's basically all I have for the wallets. Do you want to move on to another topic, or should we save that for another show, maybe later on this week?
Well, we've kind of talked about mining a little bit already, you know, so we can put a bell in this conversation by saying your point about if you can run a full node wallet, a desktop wallet to do this stuff, totally correct. I mean, it's really convenient to use a light wallet client like Exodus or Jax or Free Wallet or Kryptonator. Mm-hmm. I've never heard of that one, but you mentioned it.
It's a web-based wallet. It's not.
Yeah, wallet.
It's not bad. I haven't had any issues with it yet. So,
sure. I mean, but these types of wallets all introduce counterparty risk.
Mm-hmm.
And counterparty risk is not something you want in an asset class where you're supposed to be eliminating counterparty risk and being your own bank. If you can run a full wallet on your desktop, and I understand it requires system resources, you probably don't want to run it on your day-to-day laptop. You know, the best way to do it is either to dedicate an entire machine to it, or another guide that we're going to have up on the website soon, make an encrypted Linux USB boot drive, to have a full Linux OS on there, store all of your wallets on there, and only plug it in when you need to spend from it. That's I think a really good way to do it.
And you know, go ahead and finish, and then I think I got something.
Oh no, I just wanted to echo that sentiment wholeheartedly, man. Because a lot of people, you know, they get into it because you know people usually get into cryptocurrencies through Bitcoin or Ethereum, one of those vectors, and then they start playing around with these other altcoins, and then they might lose money on an exchange, or they might hear about exchanges going bankrupt and feel they need to get their coins off of it. And it's kind of an out of the frying pan into the fire type thing, where if you were to have moved your coins from Bitfinex because they got hacked in November of 2016 to Jax,
whoops,
you know, yeah, you're in potentially a world of hurt. Whereas if you had done a little bit of extra research and installed a full node client, then unless it's running again on a compromised operating system, no one's going to take those coins.
This is very true. So I was just going to say, brainstorming on online or live, I think that it would be beneficial for us to possibly record the creation of my USB boot drive and have that be a visual resource for people, as I could record my desktop and I could record our conversation and you walking me through it. That would give some people like myself that are visual learners and a better tutorial than just something written on a piece of paper. But I don't know if it'll work or not. We can give it a shot.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, Jake, because I've been trying to figure out how I'm going to... Obviously, I don't want to make this just text because it is a beginner guide. I want to, at the very least, have accompanying screenshots for every single step. I've been thinking, well, how am I going to screen cap the install of a fresh boot medium where I can't necessarily install screen cap tools and then, you know, pull the images from a drive that's going to wipe itself the second I unplug it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what's going to end up having to happen is I'm going to actually have to take a physical picture of my screen is the easiest way. I was thinking of like some esoteric way to do it. I was like, oh, I can install a virtual machine, spin up some VMware installation, and then I can screen cap it that way. But it's like, do I really want to, you know, spin up a whole virtual machine just for this one tutorial? And the answer is probably no. So.
Sorry, guys. Well, we tried. Well, we'll continue to work on that. But Josh, it's a pleasure always to talk to you about this. It's something you and I both believe in. Mainly me for philosophical reasons. But thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me this morning and share our experiences about this wallet.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on, Jake. And we got to talk a little bit about our mining endeavors, and maybe next time we will go into more detail about how Your goal of building a personal computer, learning how to assemble one this year was fulfilled by mining. Mm-hmm. How not only is it a great way to make passive income and to support this network, but it's a great way to gain new skills. And you can force yourself in mining to learn a lot of different things. Right now, Jake, both of us are mining on Windows, which it's not the smartest idea, but the overclocking tools for Windows are much better for these cards nowadays. It's a lot easier to set up. In the early days, it was actually probably a little bit easier and more customizable to run a Linux miner. Mm-hmm. When I was in it in 2013. But at that time, you did it. You built this machine because you wanted to learn how to assemble the hardware.
Yep.
That's my end, I had already built many, gaming computers and Hackintoshes and put together, x86, 64 PCs in the past. What I wanted to do, and I'd also used Linux, but I wanted to force myself to get decent at navigating the command line. Mm-hmm. And boy, will mining do that for you. At least it did in the early days.
Hey, and I learned some scripting because I had to move my wallet from one to another and wasn't able to get a hold of you. So did what everybody does and just started monkeying with stuff. Obviously, saving my data. Always save your data before you start monkeying, whether you're doing web development or you're doing mining. But was able to do it by myself, and the feeling that you get when you complete a task like that you don't have the skill set for at the time, but then you eventually come to fruition and you do development, something that works, it's a very fulfilling process.
Yeah, Jake, you're talking about running your or changing your config file.
Yeah,
which is always an interesting first experience when you get in there because you don't know what's going on. But then once you get the logic of it, it's pretty it gets easier as it goes.
And then we'll have to talk about our experience building my mining rig over Skype and challenges that we ran into together that were making me sweat a little bit about having to explain to my wife how I spent $1,500 on a machine that didn't really work.
Oh, mining rigs are always finicky at first, but once you get them up and running, they're pretty solid. But yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the scripting angle, Jake, because on your Zcash wallet how you have to start the node and the GUI separately.
Yep.
So I've got a little Linux shell script written that actually it's like a two-line script, but all it says is run the full node, and then only if the full node updates completely, kick on the GUI wallet. So I just have to click on one icon instead of clicking on two. But these are just cool little things that, I tried to learn Java and C++ when I was in high school, and I told myself that I wasn't good enough to do those things. Mostly because, looking back, I had very poor instruction. Mm-hmm. And it's sad because that scared me away from looking at a command line for a really long time. But now that I'm starting to get back into it and I've explored it as a hobbyist, I really do want to learn on a more intensive level. So yeah, that's, Jake, as you were saying, set personal goals for yourself and acquire skills, guys, because we are more than just cryptocurrencies as a vehicle for saving your wealth. We're entering this whole new economy where corporate jobs, six-figure jobs where you sit there for 30 years and you get a nice pension, These are not going to exist anymore, guys. Mm-hmm. Or at least they're going to exist in very limited supply. And you might not want to be working there because you slave away and exchange your lifeblood for someone else's vision. And that really sucks. So as Lee Organza of the Wealth Research Group podcast would say, now is a time, the greatest financial investment you can make is an investment in yourself and your skills, and making sure that your skill set can support an income through the most trying of times. And hopefully we'll get to the point where cryptocurrencies can be a part of that, where these freelancing websites that run through PayPal and the Fedwire system and all this garbage, we can do away with that and use a free currency for free people. Jake, on that note, do you have anything to say before we sign out?
No, that was beautiful. That's how we end it.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for joining us, guys. Thanks, as always, for letting us in between your ears. And we will talk to you probably, if not later this week, sometime next week.
That's right. Catchphrase coming soon.